I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the serial entrepreneur Gary Kremen. Gary is the founder of Match.com, an online dating service that he started in 1993. In addition to Match.com, you owned a number of generic domain names, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, and then sex.com, which was later the subject of a lawsuit. Whom did you acquire these domain names from in the early 1990s?
There was one organization giving them away, and no one thought of going to ask. So I had an epiphany that generic words that are in the classified advertising would be very valuable one day. So there happened to be a little government contractor called Network Solutions in Herndon, Virginia, that somehow wrangled the exclusive right to give out these domain names, and they weren't getting paid per domain name because they were free. They were getting paid by, they would add up their costs and add 20% and charge the National Science Foundation for it. They were basically an office of four or five people who coordinated the handing out of IP addresses and domain names and associated internet artifacts. And they hit on, and I think about 95, that they should be charging $75 from that. That later was bought by VeriSign and became a huge public company just based on the revenue from that.
Did you pick up the phone and call them and say, hey, I want to buy jobs.com?
So I sent in to an email address and I said, I wanted jobs.com, and I filled out a form. And I did that for all the domain names except the one that I did last, which was sex.com. And I realized, okay, I don't want this to get lost in email or someone on the other side to see what a good idea is. So I sent in a certified letter, and that was really good because there was a record of a certified letter.
So going back to Match.com, you raised about $4 million from angel investors and venture capital funds, and they invested in Electric Classifieds, which owned Match.com. And very early on, you and they did not see eye to eye. What are some examples of divergent points of view?
There was a couple different divergent points of view. Divergent point of view number one was, I believe that working with newspapers was doomed to fail. They were slow. They didn't get it in today's vernacular. Most of my board wanted to go work with newspapers, and that's kind of how they thought, well, let's go work with big companies. That's good. And I felt smaller entrepreneurial companies would grab the market, and I was actually right on that. Number two is, once when Match took off, I wanted to focus on that. I wanted to run with the winner. And they were like, well, let's go be the outsource partner for newspapers. And I just felt too slow. We'd never get there.
You owned a number of domain names at the time, jobs.com, housing.com, autos.com, sex.com. And they were fine with putting all these domain names under the auspices of Electric's Classifieds, except for sex.com. Why did they not want sex.com in there?
Well, it was one in a many series of embarrassments that traditional stodgy venture capitalists who are backed by pension funds feel. The word sex were embarrassed. When I introduced gay dating, they almost had heart attacks right there and then, and they kind of told me not to do it, and I did it anyhow. When I said not everyone's for marriage, some people are looking for shorter-term relationships, I think I almost got fired that day.
Sex.com ended up being not just a scandalous affair, which we'll get to, but also your most lucrative domain name that you owned.
That's true. That's true. So that was another strategic mistake they made. I mean, I made a lot of my own mistakes, please. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm Mr. Mistake.
So what are some other mistakes that you made in the early days of Match.com?
So didn't understand the importance of who's on your board. Thinking all money is green was a big mistake. And I think I was pretty abrasive as a leader. I mean, I made a lot of leadership mistakes. I think I got the strategy right, for sure, but the tactics I wasn't as good at.
I heard a story that you fired a personal assistant or an administrative assistant because she wouldn't work 7 days a week. Is that true?
That's true, because everyone else was working 7 days a week, and it felt that there's always something to do, even if it's emptying the wastebasket, and I felt that wasn't team spirit if you're going to take Sundays off. Because I was working Sundays, and I expected everyone else to work Sundays.
You were the CEO of Match.com for the first 2 years before you were ousted by the board.
That's right.
How did you feel when they voted you out?
You know, it hurt my feelings. I think that was one area where they were right. I was not mature enough to see that back then.
But at the time, you were just despondent and thought, these guys don't know what they're talking about.
Well, I have another good story. So when I raised money from the investors I did raise the money from, I had an offer from another set of investors, a more prestigious set of investors, like the best venture funds, Kleiner Perkins, IVP. And their condition on the investment was that I bring in a CEO. They had two conditions. One is bring in a CEO, and they would be let me part of the process. And two, they wanted to merge me with this other company, and I would have half the equity, and these other six people would have the other half of the equity. But no, they taught me in school, you want to be the leader, you want to be the CEO. So I said no. So I took the people who said you could be the CEO. Now that company went on, those six guys went on to change their name from Architects to Excite. And I would have had half of Excite and part vested too. One of those, you know, couple $100 million mistakes that are common in my career.
And Excite went on to
be worth... Excite at home and worth billions at the peak.
You left the company after 2 years, and the company was ultimately sold in 1997 for $7 million to Sendint, which is a consumer service company. And a year and a half later, the company was sold for $50 million to CitySearch Ticketmaster, which is owned by IAC, Barry Diller's Interactive Corporation. You made $50,000 from that sale.
I did.
How did that happen?
Well, it was part of the dispute over what direction the company wanted to do. But actually, the story worked out okay. I'll tell you the whole story. So what happened is I said, no, let's focus on this winner match. Let's have nothing to do with newspapers. We had big fights over it, and the board wanted to do the strategy of enabling newspapers to get online. And after they sold it, after my fervent objective, the company raised lots of money and it went out of business in 2001.
What company?
Match.com's parent, Electric Classifieds. They raised a lot more money trying to sell the newspapers, and it went out of business.
Got it.
So that was bad. But the good thing is I invented a bunch of things, and we got some patents. Like, I invented dynamic web pages, something every website uses today. So in 2004, a couple years later, I went and bought the debt in the last round, and I had a foreclosure sale to get that patent. And some other bidders came in, and I owned enough debt that on my $30,000 investment, I made a couple $1 million. So okay. That's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
So it was more than $50,000 in a very indirect manner.
Yeah, it was very indirect. But the real thing, $50K.
You had given up equity along the way, ultimately?
Oh, yeah. And it's not that anyone else made any money. In fact, I think I was the only one who got any liquidity, even $50K. They all lost everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Gary Kremen, the founder of Match.com, the world's largest online dating service. After the sale of Match.com, how were you doing?
Well, I was definitely bumming about the situation, but it was in such a good time in 1997 where a lot was going on. And I did have some unique knowledge. So I started working with a guy or two who had some ideas around collaborative filtering, something we see recommendation engines back then, and got that merged with a company called Firefly, and we eventually sold it to Microsoft.
For how much?
That was, I think, total $40 million. Mm-hmm. So that didn't suck.
Contemporaneous with these successful investments, you had a tumultuous period with a lawsuit over the ownership of sex.com. You had owned the domain name and contended that somebody had fraudulently taken it from you. Can you describe that briefly?
Sure. So I registered the name in 1994, first person who ever registered it. And I wasn't really focusing on it. I had all these other entrepreneurial things I was working on. And one day someone said, hey, didn't you own that name, sex.com? And I'm saying, yeah. And they go, no, this guy, Stephen Michael Cohen, has it's registered under his name. And I'm like, what? And I look it up, and it was true. It did. So I found out Mr. Cohen, who is a 5-time convicted felon, bankruptcy fraud, obstruction of justice, impersonating a judge, impersonating a lawyer, he stole the name from me. And he started, put up a website, and he was soon making about $1 million a month off the name.
Now, at the time, ownership of URLs or of domain names wasn't as secure as it is now, because it was really still the early days. So when you say he stole the name from you, how did that happen?
So initially, this is going to sound dumb, but I didn't realize how valuable the name was. I didn't know anything about the sex industry. I didn't realize it was such a big deal. So I had a little kind of investment firm, and there was a lawyer just fresh out of law school named Sherry Falco, and I gave her $2,500 to go investigate what happened, and that's how the whole thing started. And she found out about this, and then she got a call from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office saying, well, the reason Mr. Cohn now has the name, even whether he took it or not, is he had a trademark on the name. So we let it drop. We found out later that he was impersonating the USPTO, one of many things that he's impersonated in the case. So after
he had called her directly?
Oh, yeah, and said he was from the Patent and Trademark Office. And she believed it, and I believed it, too. And it hit us later that you can't have trademarks on generic words. So eventually we filed this lawsuit.
And so you found yourself associated with the porn industry pretty publicly. What was your view of that?
Well, what can you do? I needed the money. Well, at the time, I was having legal bills of $100,000 or $200,000 a month. I needed financial support for what I was doing. I didn't have liquidity from my investments yet.
And how much of your mind space or of your headspace was this lawsuit taking up while you were trying to focus on your investing?
Well, eventually, it took up 110% of my time. I learned the law. I read every brief, every pleading, which there was over 1,700. It's the longest case, I believe, in the Northern District.
When you finally got sex.com back, what did you do with the site until you sold it?
So I didn't want to run an adult site, and I came up with the idea of turning it into a search engine because there was so much traffic, and then selling those search results to other search engines. And eventually I sold it.
Isn't that effectively running an adult site or perpetuating the porn industry?
Okay, I didn't kill the porn industry. I had to eat. I had to pay my $5.6 million of legal bills I had.
And your judgment was $65 million in damages, but you didn't get the $65 million, so...
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I've still been collecting. So all I got out of it was a lot of heartache. I did get a house eventually. I did take the bad guy's house, and I lived in it for a couple of years.
Really? How did it make you feel to be, like, in the bedroom of the bad guy? Why would you do that? Of all houses you could choose.
It was kind of a nice house. It was in Rancho Santa Fe, which is this nice area of... Yes, that's true. Yeah, nice area of San Diego. And I just, I don't know, you know, there was something to it because he tormented me so much. Yeah, there was a little redemption. I mean, some of it was functional. Some might be dysfunctional. I sold it a couple of years ago.
Your income stream has been kind of erratic, it seems. You haven't had a steady flow of income.
I have not, and banks are always saying something to me about that.
Was there a time after you started Match.com where you were worried about, you know, your financial state?
No, because I was always living pretty low. So I was living in the Western Edition section of San Francisco in a $300 share, and I was eating burritos for years and years and years. So I kept my burn rate super, super low. And the landlord didn't like the fact that I wasn't making any money. And I don't know. So I'm actually sometimes a nice person. So I met this like semi-homeless guy and I let him sleep on my couch for a couple days. And he took some pictures of the guy leaving and he tried to evict me.
You have since moved away from the dating and the adult industry to a cleaner energy, the cleaner energy sector. How have you made that shift? Was it a mindful shift or an accidental one?
Well, I've always been interested in not always the energy part, but sustainable living and systems that would work forever and that were light touch on the environment, kind of leaving no trace. I've always had an interest in that area. So just after I sold sex.com, I invested in a friend's company, and she had women-friendly solar panels was her idea. So I gave her money to kind of produce these, well, what I thought they were going to be mustard or taupe-colored solar panels, racking systems, because her belief was that women were some of the big decision makers in the purchase of solar, and they're ugly. And if they made it, and it made sense to me. So what happened was not as many people were buying the mustard or taupe colored panels as she thought. And I asked her why. And I go, aren't you selling to all these rich people? She said they don't have the money up front for it. Hmm. And I had this epiphany of the idea of why not create a financing company to finance solar panels. And if the financing product would be correctly designed, the consumers would pay less than the cost of energy from their utility bill, and they'd want to sign up for that. And that actually worked out. I wrote some software that helped the installer do their job, and then they all ran this software, and then we introduced the financing product eventually. I mean, there was a lot of twists and turns.
Now, Kleiner Perkins is one of the investors in this company. Who are the other venture folks?
Claremont Creek Ventures, Google, Clean Pacific Ventures, and a lot of individual angels, including myself.
Were you at all worried that your reputation would be tainted in this new chapter of yours as you were raising capital, for instance?
I was a little bit. The good news is investors want to make money, and, you know, any challenges in reputation stop when you have a good idea. They want to make money. They don't care about the past as much, I found. Hmm. As an investor, I'm kind of like that, too.
This time around, you brought in a CEO. You knew you didn't want to be the CEO. Is that just a matter of growing up? I mean, you were 30. You were in your late 20s, early 30s when you were launching Match.com and trying to run it. Is there anything else that is attributable to this change?
Well, I've heard, Jessica, if someone hits you on the head enough times, you remember, like, oh, I don't want to be hit on the head. So I remembered, I'm not that good of a manager of people. Why don't I find someone who is a good manager of people?
Now, your other company, Sociogramics, which you launched in 2010, is a financial service company that facilitates lending to the underbanked. And you're using social media tools to help determine credit worthiness. What's an example of a social media tool that you might use to influence responsible borrowing?
Let me give you a really clear example. Today, when someone applies for a loan, if they can't find them at the credit bureau, they're usually just denied unilaterally. But there's a lot of people who aren't in the credit bureau or don't have an extensive credit file. We believe that using social media, finding their profiles out there and other traces of them and other ways of verifying they're real people with real jobs, that's good enough reasons to lend to them.
Your idea for Sociogramics came from a personal place. What is that story briefly?
So I had a great relationship with a bank in Marin, California, and I knew the officers there. They knew my story. They knew my situation, and they could tailor products and services to me. The bank got taken over by a large bank, Union Bank, and it was like night and day difference. Instead of talking to the CEO when I had a need or my representative, it was a call center. And the relationship soured quickly, and it got me thinking why the personal touch is not only important from the consumers, it's important from the bank side. So I got thinking, is there a way we could use software to bring back community lending? One of our ideas is start bringing back essays and having people write about what they're going to do with the money and what's there been history of repayment. And I think there's a lot of efficacy to that.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
I'm honored to be here, Jessica.
My guest has been Gary Kremen. Coming up, we'll meet Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.